This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Welcome to Critics at Large, a podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Vincent Cunningham.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
And I'm Nomi Fry. Hello, critics.
Hello. Hello, critics.
Hello, yes. Critics. Critics, hello. Each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. Today is a kind of special episode for us, I think, because we are going to spend this entire episode talking about criticism. Sorry.
we're going meta.
We're going meta, you guys. We're going to pull back the curtain a little bit. Just a smidge. And, you know, I think this is a topic that feels kind of urgent right now in a variety of ways. We've been hearing a lot about how criticism is a dying art form. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hope it's not a I hope that's not the case. But there is kind of a rampant disinvestment in arts journalism, yeah. Right? Fewer and fewer jobs and so on.
Yeah, I think, you know, we don't want to get defensive about who we are and what we do.
God forbid.
Criticism is under attack.
Yes.
We hear all the time, as Nomi said, about the death of criticism. There is also, I would argue, the kind of a critical populism going on, which can definitely be a force for good, but it can also be a force for chaos. And, you know, I think there is a difference between being a critic as a, what's the word I'm looking for? Vocation.
A calling.
Yes, a calling. Like, a calling, a sense of purpose and profession versus a kind of weighing in thumbs up or thumbs down.
Right.
That's right. And for many reasons, criticism is often misapplied and thought of as that up and down or like a kind of hating or a way of some extreme aesthetic snob being like, I want to take away your Marvel movie or whatever.
Right.
I want to rip the popcorn out of your out of your hands.
What if you suddenly rip the
popcorn? What if I was just like, everywhere. I love popcorn, by the way. So I think that this thought of us as these sort of like permanent curmudgeons.
Yes.
As opposed to what we are, which is people who love fun, want experience to be as full of itself as possible, right?
Yeah. No. I mean, I remember buying popcorn to see Schindler's List.
Oh my God.
I'm fun.
There's many possible titles for your tell-all, but that's one of them.
I think that's a neutral. That's relating to criticism, that's just a pure neutral.
Yeah.
Okay, but a bit more seriously, what do you guys want this episode to do?
Well, to me, criticism is the art of thinking seriously about something in public. And so when I say that that we're going meta, I want us to do that about criticism. I want us to think deeply about what the art of criticism is and does when it's at its best in public.
Mm.
And also, I mean, the other thing that our show is about how much enjoyment you can get out of art. And I think that criticism is underutilized as an art form, that it is an art form out of which you can derive entertainment.
Yeah.
Not just subsidiary
Absolutely.
From the art that it discusses, but it is a great way to enjoy yourself. And so if we can
Absolutely.
Recommend some to our listeners, that would be an add to the positive of their possible enjoyments.
Yeah, this is not homework, right? Have fun with it.
Have some fun.
So, you guys, that's our show today. Criticism and why it matters. So, I'm just curious to start with, you know, how you guys answer the question of what criticism is. What do you think is the work of a critic today?
Maybe I can answer that by starting with what I think, who I think a critic is.
Okay.
Which is that it's someone who, I'm going to keep using this word because it is who I am, loves.
Yes.
Experience. I think it's okay. Something, it is a disposition that comes even before attention to art. It's someone that looks at any phenomenon. I could look around the room that we're in and locate any of them and wants to extend their life by
engaging,
paying attention, by analysis, by I want to juice this aspect of experience for all that it's worth, right?
Yeah.
Someone who is like, in one way, and not to be morbid, but like battling death by saying, I could extend this moment and this one and this one and this one by way of attention.
Yeah.
And so the best way to practice that disposition happens to be on art.
Yeah.
And therefore uses their taste, uses their standards, uses their whole apparatus of judgment really to express a kind of joy in like being alive at the same time as the thing.
Yeah. No, I love that. That's absolutely beautiful. And it also strikes me just as you're talking, the question of attention, you know, we talk so much about the crisis in attention that we're all experiencing now. And so arguably the work of criticism is a kind of like training of one's attention in a concerted way. Yeah,
it's harder and harder to do.
It's harder and harder to do. So that's another thing that you know we can think about a little bit today. What about you, Alex?
Well, I just want to say that I loved everything Vincent just said, and it really made me light up from within like a beautiful rice paper lantern.
I did feel tears, you know, threatening once again here in the studio to come to my eyes. Well, let's face it.
I love it because for me, what is criticism for me? I said before, I think, that it's the art of thinking deeply about something in public, and I think that's true. Mm. But that may even be like the second or third step of what it is. Because first, it's about seeing and taking in and observing. You know, I think when, if I want to just think back to my own origins as a budding critic,
please.
Which frankly were really early, really, really early. I found...
Say more. You remember from...
going through the archives, going through the Schwartzian archives.
You lying know, in your crib. Yeah. You know.
I mean, so my parents were boxing up my room recently, and I found a self-published newspaper that I had written, I guess, on like a rainy afternoon when I was maybe 9.
Oh my God, I had the same thing.
Yeah, I wrote all these different articles and put my friends' names on them, but it was really like I was the whole ghostwriter. And right there in the midst of it is a review of The Diary of Anne Frank, the play, which I had just seen with a young Natalie Portman on Broadway. Oh, whoa. I was blown away.
Wow.
And... that sense of I've seen something and I want to convey what the experience of seeing it was like. And I also, and this is, I think, something very important about what being a critic is, because you have to obviously have a confidence in your own judgments. And the way that often that confidence comes to me is a sense that there's something that isn't operating on the surface, but I think I can see what it is. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell people what that thing is. And I want to figure it out for myself.
No, I think it's true. I mean, for me, I also, at around age 9 or 10, wrote these like little magazines with one of my best friends.
Really?
And I did write reviews, but mine were spoof reviews. I made up TV shows and movies.
This doesn't surprise me at all.
And I reviewed them in using language that I read, sort of like... knowingly spoofing the cliches.
You were getting the idiom
kind of like
down.
Mass media criticism.
Yeah.
What about you, Vincent? Do you have any early experiences of being a critic, a young critic?
It's so funny. I have two sort of like almost sensory moments that I think contribute to my, I guess, ability to do this. I don't know if it's like sort of my desire or whatever, but certainly my ability to do it. One was very young. My father was an artist. He was a church musician. But I remember being in our house listening to my father play and realizing, I remember the moment that I realized that there was a such thing as harmony. Yeah. Like that there was like this whole like sort of surface of a sound that was the song, but like, oh wow, it's working vertically in this way too. Like if you pay attention, you can hear the different notes and like, but you have to listen really closely. And I remember being on the floor of our apartment and just like sort of listening and being like, wow, I understand why I like feel this like this hum, this like that something's happening and I can like hum along, but there's another kind of depth that only appears out of listening, right? And the other thing, also connected to our life as a family, was sitting in church and being like, and this is, again, the presumption, listening to preachers and being like, you kind of missed it. Like, you should have said that instead of, like, you had a good line here, and there was, like, a next moment, and, like, my first actual acts of criticism were to myself about oratory.
Oh, I love that.
So you were both a theater critic and a literary critic in that moment.
That's right.
Mm.
It's true.
We all have writers, too, right, who inspire us. And one of the reasons we started talking about doing this episode in the first place is that our colleague at the magazine, Joan Acocella, one of the great critics of The New Yorker, passed away a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And that got us thinking, you know, about what makes a great critic. And Alex, I know you in particular wanted to talk today about Joan and her work. Why is that?
I love the work of Joan Acocella. I just love it. I wrote about her after she died for the magazine. And one thing I said was that a new piece by Joan was a reason to cancel plans. And that was not hyperbole. Why do I love her writing?
Yeah.
Well, one reason is that criticism, that the critic's job is to write for the reader, which I know sounds obvious, but I don't think it is. And for me, Joan was able to bring in the reader better than anyone else to all kinds of topics, high, low brow, everything in between. She was totally great about that. So I want to read you. Can I just give you an example of what
yes,
I'm talking
please,
about?
Please do.
All right, let me pull it up. So one of her great subjects as a dance critic was Mikhail Baryshnikov. And she has a profile that she wrote of him for this, wrote about him for this magazine. And yes, she talks about the steps. And of course, she'll talk about, you know, pliés, et cetera. But at the end of the piece, there is a description of a particularly extraordinary performance that he gives. And she says, he rose like a piston. He landed like a lark. He took off like Jerry Lee Lewis. He finished like Jane Austen.
That's true.
From ledge to ledge of the dance, he leapt, sure-footed, unmindful, a man in love. The audience knew what they were seeing. The air in the theater thickened almost visibly. By that time, we actually wanted him to stop so that we could figure out what had happened to us. So I love that. I love that she's bringing in, I mean, look what she's doing. She's talking about Jerry Lee Lewis, rock and roll. She's talking about Jane Austen, Regency era novelist.
Mm-hmm.
She's talking about pistons, mechanics. She's talking about Lark, the natural world. And she's brought in kind of every metaphor to describe something that is defying all of them, that's making you feel the ambition and just the sheer power of what's happening. And then she says the simplest thing possible, which is we were trying to figure out what was going on. And that's like, if you want to talk about what the job of the critic is,
right,
that's the job. And I absolutely love that. And it's just a beautiful passage. You know, the other thing I just love about Joan's writing, and this has already come up a few times in this conversation already, is how funny she was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, I think funniness and humor are important in criticism, because if you don't have those qualities at all, then I don't really trust you can enjoy something. And if you can't enjoy something, I don't really want to know what you think about anything, like good or bad, basically.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's so true, and I've often thought of the closest sort of popular medium to criticism to be certain kinds of public speech, one of which would be stand-up comedy. Because it, like, classically what this comic does is point to something that we all understand
mm-hmm.
and then pull out of it something that
What's
we never would
suspenders?
Have thought. What's up exactly. Seinfeld is like the...
Right. Like, observational comedy,
yeah,
right?
I'm looking at
it's
this thing, and I'm going to tell you something else about it. And I
yeah.
think it's so true that as a form of literature, right, if you want to enjoy this form of literature, it's exactly what you mentioned, Alex, which is that, like, it is the art form of the metaphor and the simile. That is its most ardent desire, is to, like, put something next to something else and say, isn't this a lot like this? You know? And look at those things together. Doesn't that give you a whole new world of things to think about?
Can we talk for a couple minutes maybe about Joan's, the final piece of hers that was published in the magazine. This was in February of 2023. It was a book review about the Wife of Bath, the Chaucer's Canterbury Tales character, this sort of bawdy woman, married five times, very sexual and confident and funny. And I just maybe want to open with reading a couple of sentences from the beginning.
Ooh, yes,
of the
piece. I want to know what struck your fancy.
Yeah. So just to start off right at the beginning. Okay, listen to the sleet. There are a few things in our culture that almost no one dislikes. Dolly Parton, fried rice, .. I can think of something else too. For this item, the constituency is smaller. You probably have to go to college to want to vote on it, but really it or she should be included. The Wife of Bath from Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Fried rice and Dolly Parton, is this a regular lead to discussing Chaucer?
Those are two such great examples. Also, this is a sex joke. Like,
I can think of something
else
too.
It's a sex joke.
Yes. At first, I had to read those two sentences.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, she's talking about the Wife of Bath, but she's talking about something.
Yeah, you know. Let's be 100% clear. This is a sex joke, and she's about to write about one of the raunchiest characters in all of literature,
yes, so
the Wife of
sense.
Bath, who's
yeah.
talking about how much she loves sex and, you know, how all she, you know, basically wore all of her husbands out to the point of death right. with her love of sex, and how she married another younger husband disastrously because, again, he had beautiful legs, shapely legs.
Shapely legs.
Joan is she's giving it to you right at the start.
Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, you gotta love it. Yeah. You gotta love it.
And importantly, though, I think that this whole thing, right, and the same thing goes for the Pistons mm-hmm. of before, mm-hmm. is that it so clearly tells you what, if you're looking for a lesson in criticism or what's good about it, it's saying, here's this thing that by our lights is ancient.
Yeah.
And here's fried rice and Dolly Parton.
No, totally.
And saying, like,
it's a kind of
here's
liaison.
The world. Right.
It's a liaison, right? The critic here is a liaison between a thing that many people might think is elevated or maybe not for them or maybe boring or maybe, oh yeah, we read it in like
right.
freshman year lit and, you know, whatever. You know, I'll just fess up and say that, you know, Chaucer, medieval literature was never, even when I was in grad school for English, you know, never my thing. I could not be less interested. Okay? And so when—
Take that, Chaucer.
Yeah.
And so—
Hope you're rolling in your grave now.
And so when we agreed amongst ourselves that we would discuss Joan's final piece for the magazine, and it happened to be, you know, about Chaucer, I was like, ugh. But, you know, once I started reading, I was like, oh, this is just great. She's making it, and you know, and not to say she's making it relatable, like in a dumbed down way, you know, which is, there's nothing worse than that. I'm sort of like, how do you do, fellow kids? You know, trying to be like, you know what I mean? This is not Chaucer for dummies, you know, just to make clear. But it does make it alive. It makes it alive to the reader. After the break, we're going to be talking a lot more about the critics who've shaped the field and our own work. It's Critics on Critics. We'll be right back.
I love that.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
So, we discussed in advance that we would kind of share works of criticism that have been important to us, important to our development as critics, important to how we think about the work of writing about art. And I decided to select a piece from 1917 by the Russian formalist Viktor Shklovsky called Art is Technique. And this is not, I didn't select this so much for the style in which it was written, but more for how deeply it influenced me in looking at art, I guess, or thinking about art, or thinking how to write
about art.
When did
you first encounter it?
I encountered it, I believe I was still in undergrad, and then I think I re-encountered it in grad school. But to me, you know, so Shklovsky in this piece defined the concept of defamiliarization as the role of art, right? What he called making the stone stony, right? Where the way we look at life, we're numb to the world in a lot of ways, right? We look at things, but we don't really see them. We don't really observe them closely. We don't really pay attention. And the role of art, per Shklovsky, is to remind us of the world and the ways in which it's worth it to look at the world, right? It kind of reawakens us to what's around us. And when I think about criticism and about the work that criticism does, I think it needs to notice that in art, but I think it also needs to do that in criticism, right? Remind people that things aren't just like transparent and should be taken for granted and are just around us, but that in fact these things matter, you know? How about you? Is there a writer whose work helped shape the way you approach criticism?
Yeah, someone who is like, I don't know, I can't even say it strongly enough, a hero, a model, a kind of companion in my head. I have met him a couple times, and I still feel more like his friend when I read him than I do when I ever speak with him, is Daryl Pinkney, who writes mainly for the New York Review of Books. He has written some novels that I really love. High Cotton is the name of his first novel. The second one is called Black Deutschland. But his criticism is, for me, indicative of so much of what we talked about, because it really is the dispatch of someone who is always talking about art, often often literature, and often you might call it the field of African-American literature is where you can find him at his most passionate. But for him, passionate is, again, the coolness of conversation.
Yeah.
It really is a kind of talk, a kind of chatter. I'll read you a paragraph. And I just, like, I could have gone, I love so many pieces, but really, His work is more of a tapestry of all the pieces together and just like a flow of conversation. This one is about a short story collection called Loverman by a writer called Alston Anderson. But what Daryl wants to talk about here, what Daryl Pinkney wants to talk about here is Black talk or dialect in speech. That's what he like kind of, that's the thing he cares most about this book. So he starts off like this. Again, Loverman, Alston Anderson. You will not hear any of that shit in this first paragraph. James Weldon Johnson was critical of dialect because it only had two stops, pathos and humor. Mark Twain may have listened to how the Black people around him spoke, and the case has been made passionately that he gave his Black characters credit for thinking at a time when dialect was used mostly to confirm the inferiority of Black people. But even if not racist, dialect is still racialized speech. It contains the problem of having to overcome the assumption that racial distinctions will be demeaning for Black people. So already a kind of like arguing with himself. It's like, well, Twain was good with dialogue, but you can't deny that dialogue was usually used for this bad purpose. And, oh, yeah, I'm just talking about James Weldon Johnson and Mark Twain and already introducing to you something that I just care about, which is like, what does it mean to speak in dialect in literature?
Yeah.
And it just sounds like you're in the presence of somebody who cares about this. And the way that he does it, and this is why I talk about this kind of like aspect of friendship that you can sometimes get off a critic, I think, in a way that doesn't happen anywhere else. I remember, here's a story. One night, I'll never forget this. It was like 2021. And like around that time, like everybody else, I was like a little bit more anxious than I'd ever been. And I was like in the middle of the night having these like, I don't know, maybe anxiety attacks. I don't know. Like just waking up and feeling.
Who can tell?
Who can tell? Feeling like totally, talk about defamiliarization. Yeah. Just feeling like lost at sea. And in the middle of the night, I get up, like trying not to wake up my wife. And I go into the living room and I'm like losing it. And by instinct, I just picked up a copy of Daryl Pinkney's essay collection, Busted in New York. And just opened it up and started reading the paragraphs just like so I could hear a human voice. It cured me. I'm still so grateful for that moment because it's just a person who's just like me who cares about the kind of stuff that I care about. And these paragraphs wants to surround me in this mode of thought, wants to change the direction I'm going in and put me on a boat with him and just like push it off to sea very gently. So I'm Daryl Pinkney, if you ever listen to this, you probably don't, I don't know. Thank you.
Criticism saves lives.
It does.
Let's just let everyone know that criticism saves lives. But what you're saying makes a lot of sense because, well, precisely because criticism at its ideal is sense-making. That is the point. It is about making sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you're unmoored and you're totally lost and you're waking up and you don't know where you are, you got to be reoriented to sense.
Yeah. Pulled back in.
Now that everyone's a critic, why does criticism matter? Critics at Large from The New Yorker will be back in a minute.
The run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
Yeah, we support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
So, you guys, we talked about how much we love criticism. We talked about critics we love. But now we also want to discuss the sort of elephant in the room, so to speak. Is criticism in crisis? Is criticism dying? What's going on?
I think that if you look at criticism, just like as a whatever, its appearance in a certain kind of market.
Yeah.
There's no question that it is endangered, right? Like,
yeah.
With the absolute crisis that we're having in terms of just local news,
mm-hmm.
right? One place that criticism often lives is in local news because it's saying, here's what's happening in your town.
Sure.
And that sort of basic, like, review-based critical culture,
mm-hmm.
If you just look at it across the country.
In a daily paper,
very much endangered. And then if you look at the world of sort of more major newspapers, which if you look around at our world, you know, layoff after layoff seems to be the rhythm of much of the media landscape in this country, even on the sort of the higher, more national levels.
Yeah.
A lot of what we see when we see layoffs and then people not being replaced often happens in the arts pages.
Yeah.
So I think it is fair to call it a kind of crisis. What we do, which is, you know, do criticism among other things as a way of living, and you know, it feeds our families and stuff like that. Mm-hmm, is mm-hmm. It was always a privileged thing to do in a certain way, and I think it more and more is that it's a more rare thing
to have
as a facet of your life.
Yeah, you brought to our attention this piece by Jason Zinnemann, who writes, he's a critic at large for The Times, and he mostly writes about comedy, but he wrote about how the theater critic for The Washington Post, Peter Marks, recently took a buyout, and now The Washington Post will no longer have theater criticism,
right?
And he was using it as a kind of example of what is happening more generally in arts criticism.
There's something very specific about theater criticism that I think we should say, which is that, you know, because one thing going on, like, Vincent, I agree with you. I think criticism is definitely in crisis. It's one of these crises that's been slow rolling over a long period of time. So we've been used to hearing about it for, at this point, many, many years. But the trends are clear. And one reason for the decline in these pages, of course, is that a lot more people are practicing criticism than ever. They're just doing it online or on Twitter or on social media or on blogs or whatever. Like, you don't have to be a professional critic to get your opinion out. And so the thing I want to say specifically about theater is that's a lot harder with theater to do that than it is with, for instance, a TV.
Netflix.
Yeah,
shows.
For TV, that's for books, whatever. You just need to, like, go to the library or turn on your television. With theater, having done this, I can tell you, there's no rush like going in with those press tickets that you didn't have to pay for, because otherwise it's prohibitive. It, like, totally is prohibitive.
You can't do it.
So when you lose a theater critic, you are losing eyes on work for sure. And you're losing the person who is telling other people about the work. And this was part of Jason Zinnemann's argument. You're impoverishing the entire ecosystem, the artistic ecosystem that depends on, you know, on work being made, on being seen, and on being responded to. When you lose that, I really do think it's, like, a big impoverishment in that way.
Right.
And the other thing I do want to say, I think professional criticism has become nicer. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that.
Yeah.
Like, a good one might be that I do think there is, like, a bit more of a compassion or an empathy for the art maker, perhaps, going on with a professional critic, where they're like, oh, God.
Especially when you consider the market forces that we're all sort of, like, rocked to and fro by. It's like everything feels in some way, because of the conditions we're all toiling in, harder.
There's a reason to be more sympathetic to the work, perhaps. You know, I think that can be good. I also think it can be totally corrupting and condescending, because like what you're describing, Nomi, which I totally agree with, is, like, one step from condescension, where you can be like, oh, you put on your
play, nice.
That's so great. Let's like compliment you for that. And, like, no, this is not, you know, how we should be thinking about it. But I do think there is generally a sense of maybe more just sympathy for the difficulty of artistic experience. Mm-hmm. But I think another reason it's nicer is that, you know, now that we live in the moment of, like, great populist waves of criticism, there's a different valence to that. Like, one thing that I've been thinking about is we really are in a moment of everyone being a critic and people coming for the critics.
Oh my God.
And so with that, you know, like, do you dare to be a Scott going against Marvel and, like, being attacked by
a million fanboys?
Yeah, a bunch of people. Like, maybe you do, maybe you don't. But I think that is part of what's going on. Like, we're seeing the weaponization of criticism. I was very struck by this op-ed I read by Maris Kreitzman in the New York Times recently about Goodreads, for instance. Mm-hmm. And there have been a bunch of scandals with Goodreads where people are kind of weaponizing the review mechanism, you know, like creating false accounts and bombing other writers they're in competition with, and all this stuff. Like, it's brutal out there. And that's we're getting farther and farther away from what criticism is when you get to stuff like that.
Yeah, it's kind of, it goes into vendetta mode, and it's not totally clear ever, or sometimes it's clear, sometimes it's not clear why people would do that even, you know, except the impulse to troll, as we know in a lot of different facets of our lives right now, is strong. Sometimes it's just pure, you know, shit posting or pure, you know, and it's, but of course that has real life effects, and to think about that kind of thing, you know, giving something one star and being like, this sucks, you know, and I'm not saying anyone who's not a professional critic is a dummy who gives one star, and every critic is like a valiant hero who, you know, brings their best self to the table every single time. But you know, generally speaking, I think there is a kind of gap between these two things.
I mean, I just want to be very clear that I'm not at all against the rise of like the reviewing culture more generally. And I actually think there is something about reviewing culture that can keep professional critics honest. Like, it can kind of give you a bracing sense of critical reality to check in to see how, like, many other people are experiencing the thing.
Yeah.
And there are, like, brilliant, you know, people are writing brilliant stuff. Like, in no way am I just saying, like, leave it to the professionals, everyone.
No, not at all.
But I do think, yeah, there's something interesting going on there.
Yeah. But I think, this is, I think, a product of some historical realities that have changed quite a lot just in the last couple of decades, right? So, for example, the Jason Zinnemann piece that we were talking about theater criticism and the unfortunate departure from the scene of Peter Marx, who was really an admirable critic. Mm-hmm. One thing that Jason talks about, and it really is one of the sort of third rails of this conversation, is the actual amount of real power, economic power, critics either have or once had. Mm-hmm. So especially like a theater critic, the thing was, you know, especially if you're the critic at the New York Times, this used to be the case, you could close a show or keep it open with your review.
Right.
A day after your review, if it's a total pan, like the show would start folding, and the opposite, if you gave it a great review, the ticket sales would pump up. So this true power that they had, right, which was, we should say, often abused.
Yeah.
There were many critics. I can think of many. I'll name one. John Simon, a critic who died not long ago, a theater critic. I mean, he was just vicious for no reason. And you would read the pieces and wonder, do you even like this art form? You know, so there is a way to, number one, just abuse the attention of the reader, but also abuse the power that you have as a critic. Mm-hmm. And this did happen. I think less than is often sort of imputed to us, but it did happen. But also just the fact that criticism does on some level operate as publicity. And this is the thing that we always try not to allow into our work. We try not to allow into our sort of our mindset as critics.
Yeah,
but it's just true that if there is 1,000 words about anything in a big newspaper, then more people know about it, right?
Yeah.
It's true. Like, so something that we write about, it changes minds, it introduces to people or whatever.
Sure.
And so besides what we've said about criticism as a kind of literature, what I believe it is, it is also on this other side, this more sort of whatever, dollars
and
cents
side. It's part of the ecosystem.
It's a part of an ecosystem that creates a culture where people go and see things, care about them, whatever. And if, so you mentioned A.O. Scott, the former film critic at the Times, now more of a sort of critic at large, who writes about books and things. I should admit, A.O. Scott, Tony Scott, friend of mine, love him. He had this thing where Samuel L. Jackson, after...
Oh, I remember.
Yeah, after Tony wrote this negative review of the Avengers movie, Samuel L. Jackson goes on Twitter and says, hashtag Avengers fans, NY Times critic A.O. Scott. By the way, he talks like the New York Post. NY Times critic A.O. Scott needs a new job.
Oh,
let's help
God.
Him find one he can actually do. So it's like this weaponization. It's like Sam Jackson fucking knows better because he's great. He's got amazing talent. I love him. But part of the reason he exists is because perceptive critics have shared with us what's good about his work. So
yeah,
you get a bad review for a fucking corporate thing, and
yeah,
all of a sudden
it's a corporate.
You're...
It's the sort of bullying trope, right? Like the critic is a bully. I'm like, it's a Marvel. Like, relax.
You're on the side that's got all the money
yes,
and all the power.
It's like it's fine.
I'm an ink stained wretch just trying to tell people.
Totally.
You know, and
yeah.
so this
well, it is,
this
it is,
attitude is, yeah, is part of the problem.
It is so interesting how people deal with tough critics. You know, I was reading a lot over the weekend about Tom Shales, the Washington Post TV critic, mm-hmm. because he died last week, and there was a lot of public mourning on Twitter among people who'd been, you know, who syndicated and so was read really, really widely. And I'm reading some negative reviews this guy wrote. Like, I'm reading some mean stuff. And it, one thing that the, like, I was just glancing at Shales' review of The O.C., from my own teen years.
Never forget.
And it's just scorching. Like, the first paragraph, you know, I'm sorry, this piece begins, encumbered by a script that is nearly breathtaking in its imbecilic banality. That's a subordinate clause. We don't even know what he's talking about. The OC makes one long for the cold comforts of a sleazy-minded reality show. So it's like, okay, that's a drive-by on reality shows. Like, that's just, you know, forget it. Like, he's just gone two for the price of one. But what I like about that kind of mean criticism, you know, I'm not someone who loves meanness for the sake of meanness at all, and I don't get my kicks that way. But, you know, one thing I do appreciate about that review of The OC is, like, I think Shales was going at what he considered to be really brainless, corporatized entertainment. And kind
totally.
Of, like, you know, he said of Josh Schwartz, the showrunner, who at that point was 26, like, well, he didn't waste any time in selling out. Like, whoo!
Well, it was a different time.
It was a different time, but...
There's a thing, just, it was just...
Which is why of, we can sort of enjoy it
well,
now.
That kind of harsh, you know, clarity, like, there can be a time and place for it. There can.
Before we leave each other, I guess I want to ask you... why does criticism matter? Okay, after all we've talked about, you know, the rise of the popular critic, the contraction of the field, our own, you know, love of the work, and yet, you know, the difficulty in pursuing it. What do you guys think?
I think that criticism matters because of a little bit of what I was saying about Jonah Coachella in that first couple of sentences of the Wife of Bath piece, which is art enters our lives at moments and in contexts, at spots in history, and touches places in us that are either personal or public.
Mm.
And that encounter, the moment of encounter between ourselves and the work of art, our time and the work of art, whatever, our political happenstance, circumstance, and the work of art, is itself an aspect of experience. That encounter is an event, and somebody's got to speak up for that event.
That's beautiful.
Agree. Co-sign,
mm-hmm.
as it were.
Thank you.
Nomi.
Yeah, it's about engaging with the world, and it's about thinking that art is important. It's about also, for me personally, finding out what I think about something, mm-hmm. you know? It's a process of discovery for me. Criticism is a process of discovery, and I hope that this discovery is present for whoever is reading what I'm writing as well.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear.
Well, I have two things to say, and they also... lead me back to Jonah Coachella. One thing is, she said something that in her just beautiful, simple, direct, blunt style just put the words to it for me that I thought was super helpful. She said that Balanchine's work not only made me fall in love with ballet in a much more serious way than I ever would have thought about before, it made me think about life differently, about how you should live, what you should care about. And the interviewer says, can you talk a little bit more about that? And she says, yes, but it's hard because we're talking about the most important things in life. Abstract art, the importance of it, imagination, transformation, the energy that transformation releases. Looking at art can be a whole life where you don't need anything more. And that is such a beautiful value. Mm-hmm. I think the art of criticism, if you get to do it, it's, and you want to do it, glorious. You get to live that life. And then the other thing that I think that I want to say, which is also to me a totally Joan quality, so I'm really just glad to be thinking and, you know, in a critical way about her, is it is about transmission. It is about bringing that to others. Like, I really find that very important, that it's about enabling others to try to see what you see and to give access and make it bigger. Like, I do think criticism is often considered a kind of gatekeeping. It really also can be the opposite. It can be a giving of access. You know, like, kind of nothing is more important than that. And that, to me, dignifies the whole endeavor.
Amen.
And now please rate and review us.
This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby, and Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from Josh Wilcox, with mixing by Mike Kutchman. You can find every episode of Critics at Large at newyorker.com/critics, and you can email us at themail@newyorker.com. We'd love to hear from you. Just make sure to include critics in the subject line. Your note will get to us faster. See you next Thursday.
I'm Jessica St. Clair, but you can call me Jess if you're nasty.
And I'm Dame Casey Wilson. We are actors, comedians, and podcasteurs. But above all else, we are self-appointed masters of small talk.
We have written a soon-to-be Nobel Prize-winning audiobook that will surely change the course of history, called The Art of Small Talk.
You can listen to the whole thing, start to finish, included with your Spotify Premium membership. Just search for The Art of Small Talk on Spotify.